Two great writers about the American West and activists.
I'd never seen a book where literary influence was this direct. I mean, Abbey actually did these things. He didn't admit it at the time. He admitted it later, but he sawed down billboards. He put sugar in gas tanks of bulldozers. He pulled up surveyor stakes. So you have, on the one hand, Stegner, who's working within the system, on the other, Abbey working without.
That's David Gessner. We talk with him about his new book, All the Wild That Remains, Edward Abbey, Wallace Stegner, and the American West. We also re-air a clip from a previous interview with Gessner about his last book, My Green Manifesto. And finally, we continue our Thanksgiving tradition, Marge Bruschek's telling of the true story of the holiday. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The American West is an imperiled treasure, threatened by drought, overgrazing, and environmental damage from oil and gas fracking. It still has some of the most spectacular scenery and wildest habitat remaining in the U.S. Wallace Stegner and Edward Abbey loved the West. Two of our greatest writers about the region, they wrote about it with great lyric power, both in fiction and nonfiction. But they did much more than that. They were activists who, in very different ways, dedicated their lives to protecting the beautiful, fragile land they loved. Stegner helped frame the 1964 Wilderness Act. Edward Abbey coined the term monkey wrenching as applied to pro-environment sabotage, and practiced it too. Now, environmental writer David Gessner has come out with an homage to Wallace Stegner and Edward Abbey, All the Wild That Remains. It is, he says, a hybrid animal, part biography, travel narrative, meditation, literary criticism, and nature writing. All these elements are woven together into one absorbing read that brings Stegner and Abbey right up to the present day as inspiration. Like them, Gessner balances the romance of the West and its reality. Well, David Gessner, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
In this book, All the Wild That Remains, it's subtitled Edward Abbey, Wallace Stegner, and the American West, you call Wallace Stegner and Edward Abbey two of the most effective environmental fighters of the 20th century. Yet we know them mostly of writers, even of fiction as well as nonfiction. Could you connect their lives as writers, including writers of fiction, and their work as environmental fighters?
Sure. I think, unlike other countries or parts of the world, Americans are pretty wary about the connection of the political and the literary, oil and water sort of thing. And with these two, there's no question that they're writers first and foremost. They're kind of still, they're writing in the 50s, 60s, 70s, even into the 80s. And they're looking back at the old Hemingway model. They definitely want to write the great American novel, and that's their first priority. But what I think is amazing is what they did on Fumes, or what they did as kind of a secondary goal, which was really make a difference environmentally. They're kind of the Mr. Inside and Mr. Outside of environmentalism or environmental writers. Stegner gets involved in the 50s in writing about the environment, and he, in part because he's writing a biography of John Wesley Powell, who went down through the Grand Canyon in the late 1800s and then came back and fought in Washington in the 1800s against a climate-denying Congress. He tried to make them see that the West was an arid place. And Stegner is inspired by this and by his friend Bernard DeVoto, and he fights to stop the Dinosaur National Monument from being dammed. And people take notice, and when Kennedy goes into office in 60, 61, Stegner goes with him, working for Stuart Udall in the Department of Interior. And there he starts to write and help form the language of what's going to be the Wilderness Act. So it's really, you know, he's really done a lot. He's has these achievements. Abbey's a kind of different animal. Abbey, through his writing, celebrates monkey wrenching or environmental sabotage. And the Monkey Wrench Gang becomes this giant hit cult book. And when I moved to Colorado in 1990, people were actually reading it, and then they were going out and committing these little acts of environmental vandalism, trying to undermine progress. And so I'd never seen a book where literary influence was this direct. I mean, Abbey actually did these things. He didn't admit it at the time. He admitted it later, but he sawed down billboards. He put sugar in gas tanks of bulldozers. He pulled up surveyor stakes. So you have, on the one hand, Stegner, who's working within the system, and on the other, Abbey working without and having a huge impact on Western environmentalism.
So introduce us to these two men, about their lives a little bit. Let's start with Stegner. Where's he from?
They're kind of two classic types of Westerner. Abbey is the Westerner who was born in the East and comes west during a hitchhiking trip when he's 17 and sees the mountains and falls in love and is kind of born again. But Stegner is born in the West, or is raised in the West. He moves from the Dakotas to Washington State, to Saskatchewan, to Montana, to Salt Lake City. And all that movement is driven, he's born in 1909, and that movement is driven by his dad, George Stegner, who's kind of the classic Western boomer. In fact, the language boomer comes in part from Stegner describing his father. And that is to say, the dad was always looking over the next hill for the big strike, whether it was in mining or farming or something where he could kind of strike it rich. And that's how Stegner got the title, The Big Rock Candy Mountain, for his long autobiographical novel. And meanwhile, Stegner's mom, Hilda, is trying to nest. Wendell Berry, who's part of the book, I visited him in Kentucky, said to me, "You've always got to remember that Hilda planted perennial flowers, always hoping that the next place was the home place." So out of these two parents, Stegner took kind of these archetypes of the boomer and the nester. And there's no question where his sympathies lie. Throughout his career, he kind of mocked or undermined the rugged individualist myth. And he said, look, this is a semi-desert or desert place. And the only way to really make it work is cooperation, not individualism. So a lot of what Stegner ended up kind of preaching and writing about in his career grew out of that childhood. As for Abbey, he comes from home Pennsylvania, sees the West, falls in love with it, and goes over to Italy during World War II, but comes back directly to the West. And he moves around a lot. He's more like George Stegner than Hilda Stegner. Moves around a lot, but writes kind of intoxicated prose about the desert. Probably his greatest book is Desert Solitaire, which is a kind of modern Walden. And it really celebrates the place and kind of the joy of loafing in that place and of kind of watching the red rocks and watching the cloud formations. So I always think that an interesting contrast is with Abbey, you get the pleasure of kind of loafing and enjoying where you are. And with Stegner, you get kind of bristling ambition because he would go on to found the Stanford Creative Writing Department. And he would, you know, just crank out books throughout. He kind of cranks his way through his career. Whereas Abbey, who, you know, was famously kind of crude and contradictory, he would wiggle through his career a little more.
And Stegner, he respected Abbey, but I'm not sure he liked him.
Well, Abbey would be the classic person that Wallace Stegner would usually dislike. For instance, Stegner disliked his student Ken Kesey, and there's a scholar who has the theory that the big nurse in Cuckoo's Nest, Nurse Ratched, was based on Wallace Stegner, so Kesey didn't like Stegner much either. The reason I think that Stegner wouldn't like a person like that is he grew up on the frontier where there were no books and no culture. if he got hold of a book, he would read and reread it, and he could quote from it 60 years later. So he thought, having grown up without culture, he idealized creating culture. He hated the 60s for that reason. It was countercultural. And in general, he didn't like the long-haired rebellious types. Abby kind of gets a pass. He's exempt from Stegner's dislike because of his love of the land. When he writes about Abby, he says, you know, he would like to criticize him, and he's kind of curmudgeonly about it, but then Abby is such a celebrator of the landscape. So the ground, the land, is what they have in common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talked about how Stegner, you know, was contemptuous of the rugged individualist and kind of the romance of the West. And you write, it seems to me that anyone who cares to really think about the planet today has to hold both these things in mind, to remember to see the beauty and to still take joy in the beauty, but not shy away from the hard and often ugly reality. So talk about the reality of the West versus the romance.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, what Stegner saw, you know, he saw kind of the way we look at the West as being like the false front of a Hollywood town. And what he saw was an arid landscape, a landscape where catastrophe might strike. Think of the fires from this summer and recent summers, and wipe out half a region, a place where farming had to be completely different than the East, where it required, say, 20 times more acreage to have a cow graze, for instance, and where often these realities were ignored. If you don't mind, I have one paragraph by Stegner that really speaks to this summer and 50 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
It goes like this. It's from The Sound of Mountain Water by Wallace Stegner. The history of the West until recently has been a history of the importation of humid land habits and carelessness into a dry land that will not tolerate them, and of the indulgence of an unprecedented personal liberty and atomic individualism in a country that experience says can only be successfully tamed and lived in by a high degree of cooperation. Inherited wetland habits have given us a damaged domain. So that's Wallace Stegner. And, you know, as I was touring for this book this summer, a young environmentalist said, "So you must get really depressed all the time when you're walking out in nature because you know all this stuff." And I said, "No, you know, that was kind of the irony of the trip this summer out west to promote this book. It's still spectacular. It's still beautiful. I still feel lifted up." So it is holding those two things in mind, and that's one reason I use these two writers, because with Stegner you get kind of this intellectual larger understanding of the place. One of my favorite Stegner quotes is, "Largeness is a lifelong matter." He meant that personally in terms of being magnanimous, but also intellectually. And with Abby, he knows all this is going on, but he's still having fun. You know, he's got a quote, "Enough with saving the world, let's go down the river." So Abby's a great reveler on the page. And I really think you still need both things, even in these distressed times. Or why are you going to fight for the place?
Right. You know, I went out to Sequoia Kings Canyon Park this summer and had an amazing time hiking in the alpine regions and in the forest, and then got home, and not a week later, but the rough fire started, and, you know, people had to evacuate the very campgrounds I'd just been in. And you know, the beauty of the place was so overwhelming, and just to hold those two things in my mind at the same time, you know, to remember the joy that I had and then the fear that I have now of what's going to happen to these regions.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that what I've been doing more and more, I thought I was going to stay in the West forever when I moved there at 30. And then I wrote a book about loving Cape Cod and moved back to Cape Cod and ended up getting a job in North Carolina. So more and more I've defined myself not by one region, but by the country. And I think one thing Stegner does that's brilliant when he thinks on this in this big picture way is he lets us connect things. So as I now live in coastal North Carolina, a landscape I've grown to love, and see the hurricanes come through mm-hmm. and hear the cries to rebuild, I think I connected instantly to the fires going through, say, the foothills of Colorado and the cries to rebuild. And in both cases, it's really not acknowledging the power of the natural world and not really showing humility in the face of what seems to come around. It's like bowling pins almost. We keep rebuilding and these things keep getting knocked down and we keep having these seemingly patriotic cries to rebuild when really it might be wise to pause for a moment and say, hey, maybe we should leave this place alone. That's part of the title of the book. The original title was Properly Wild. And the idea was it's proper to leave some lands alone. The idea also was a contrast between Stegner and Abbey, Stegner being the proper and Abbey being the wild.
Right. Have you heard of the notion of that nature needs half? Has that been a phrase that is familiar to you?
Is the last word half?
Half, H-A-L-F, nature needs half.
No.
I was just told about this the other day, and what you're saying really reminds me of this. I mean, I think actually nature needs more than half. But
right.
But the idea is that the notion that nature requires that we need to understand the needs of nature as half of what we think about no matter what we do when we're planning where we live or how we live.
Yeah. And I mean, I haven't heard the phrase, but I've certainly, you know, been versed in the idea. It seems to me that we do that, we give it a little lip service, but then whenever push comes to shove, whenever mm-hmm. an emergency comes along or human needs press in, we quickly cede. We just say, oh, that's just nature. That's just the natural world. And we give up. And we sell it down the river, no pun intended. And it seems to me that one thing about reading these two writers is they reinforce how vital the natural world is in very different ways. And that writers like this, even in their fiction and their non-overtly political writers, are huge help in kind of understanding how important the world is beyond the human.
Right. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Gessner. His new book is All the Wild That Remains, Edward Abbey, Wallace Stegner, and the American West. Now, you spoke with another one of my favorite writers about the natural world, and that's Terry Tempest Williams. And she gave you a kind of Zen koan, in a way, you call it. She told you that Edward Abbey was the conservative, while Wallace Stegner was forever the radical, kind of turning on its head our typical notions of them. What did she mean by that?
Well, I'm not entirely sure, but I chewed on it for much of the trip. You know, the book isn't a definitive biography by any means of either man. It's a woven biography with a trip around the West during which I think about a lot of these things. And as I started to think about it, it was easier at first to think of Abbey as the conservative for all his radicalism. He often made comments about immigration that would probably fit into the current Republican debates pretty well. Mm-hmm. He could be sexist, racist to some degree. Often he did that just to push buttons, but he certainly was. He was a firm believer in carrying guns. So he fit the conservative label that we think of now in some ways, but he was really radical too. When he said he was an anarchist, he meant it. He believed in kind of creative disorder. But so it was easy to imagine him as a conservative. Harder to think of Stegner as the radical. And as I started to think about it, I thought back. I drove from North Carolina out west. My first stop was at the home of Wendell Berry in Kentucky. And I started to think about what Wallace Stegner had taught Wendell Berry. For those who don't know Wendell Berry, he's a great poet, essayist, and fiction writer from Kentucky, and he studied with the man he called Mr. Stigner in the late 50s, early 60s at Stanford. And he was a star. Wendell Berry was a star writer, and he went to Europe, and he went to New York City, and he suddenly decided, I'm going to go home again to Kentucky and live there on the farms that my parents and grandparents farmed. And everybody in New York, the editors and professors all said, you're crazy. You can't go home again. This is ridiculous. And he said, no, I'm going to root down in my home place. And a lot of that grew out of working with Stegner. So Stegner's radicalism to me is kind of turning his back on the move from place to place, the rapidity and the superficial nature of like kind of modern life, and saying, find your place, root down there, and fight for it. And a lot of that, of course, grew out of having lived in the opposite way with his dad as he dragged him around the West. So I think Stegner's radicalism is a radicalism in contrast to a lot of what we value in modern society. It's a little bit of a stretch to, you know, he was also deeply conservative in some ways, but it was a fun koan, as you say, to kind of consider the two men. You know, I contrasted them all the time as I was going. I mean, I said you could write a whole chapter on their hairstyles. You know, Abbey is wild and shaggy and bearded, and Stegner a white mane with not a hair out of place. Or you could contrast them from the way they wrote in their journals about going down the San Juan River. Abbey said, I'd like to get out and roam around naked and hunt deer and live here for a year. And Stegner said, this would be a good place to get out and write a book. So, you know, one was always working and thinking of work, and the other was kind of rebelling and thinking of loafing.
They were both so great inspirations, and I remember reading The Monkey Wrench Gang. I hate to say how long ago it was that I read it, but it was a few decades ago. And Edward Abbey, as you say, he was an anarchist. I mean, he actually inspired an actual movement, a monkey wrenching movement, and, you know, kind of the earth firsters.
Yep.
And so talk a little bit about his impact on the politics of environmentalism.
Yeah, I mean, Earth First and Dave Foreman, they retreated to the desert to consider, you know, they'd been lobbyists. This is in the 70s. They'd been Washington lobbyists, and they read Monkey Wrench Gang, and they took it to the desert, and a group of them, and they decided, we've got to do something more radical. And, of course, one of the things Abbey was always fervently against was the Glen Canyon Dam and the damming of the, or the damnation, as he called it, of the Colorado River. And so in the Monkey Wrench Gang, and in real life, people kind of thought and plotted about blowing up the Glen Canyon Dam. Now, of course, this is seen in a completely different light in our post-9/11 world. And what seemed romantic maybe in the 70s suddenly seems, you know, kind of something that'll land you in prison for a very long time in the present climate. And it's true that Abbey has some kind of rough edges in common with the Unabomber. He's a solitary, bearded scribbler of manifestos, so he's got that in common. So, you know, one of the questions the book addresses, one thing I try to do is write about environmentalism then and environmentalism now. And I meet with an FBI agent in Grand Junction, and we talk a little about Tim DeChristopher, who's a modern environmentalist who bid on oil lands in Utah right as the Bush administration was leaving office. He didn't have any money to bid, but he got those lands in his hands and took them out of the oil company's hands. And that landed him in jail for 2 years in Denver, but he became kind of a hero. And I spoke to him and to an FBI agent, and we talked about the way in the old days monkey wrenching for Earth First and other places was secretive. You know, you'd do it with one or two other people and not tell anybody and sneak around. And that modern environmentalism has to be the opposite, or can be the opposite. It's almost like reality show environmentalism, where you could film yourself protesting against these places and try to reclaim the story for yourself, rather than tell a secretive story where others can kind of pin the story on you. So it's really interesting to think that say something like Whale Wars could be the modern equivalent of what Abby was talking about in the Monkey Wrench Gang, and trying to think of what is the future of this more radical sort of environmentalism.
Well, David Gessner, you talk a lot in this book also about climate change. You see what's going on in terms of fracking, and of course, fracking has is a huge threat to water supplies wherever it is. But at least in Pennsylvania, it rains. But out right. in the West, it doesn't rain so much. So those are issues. I wonder, though, if you could talk a little bit about how you see the place of wilderness in climate, you know, as we face climate change. And I guess what I'm getting at here is you talk about how climate change just makes everything, including the ability of animals to adapt, everything more difficult to adapt to it, that what's already fragile becomes more fragile.
Right. You know, as you say, fracking is a theme of the book. I go to Vernal, Utah, and go up in a plane above the town and look out at the oil and fracking lands. And I think I describe it as like a scar on a beautiful woman's face. When the land is scarred, when it's desert land, that scar can last for 1,000 years. There's a vulnerability, a fragility about dry lands that does not exist in wetter land. That's not to say that a mountaintop removal or fracking in the East isn't a dangerous thing. It's just an awareness that certain landscapes don't recover the way others do. Also interesting are the findings that the Southwest is, even to the extent where it is competitive with low-level seacoast lands in terms of the impact of climate change. I mean, in a way, it kind of seems obvious that a hot, dry place would be in trouble, but the degree to which climate change impacts like the Southwest, where drought is already cyclical, and the droughts get amped up and the droughts come more frequently, is incredible. The heating up, say, of trees and the susceptibility to fire. So, and you've also got drought and warming temperatures enabling the pine bark beetles to spread to other places they haven't been to yet, and to destroy closing in on 20% of the region's trees. So there's no kind of glossing over how brutal the picture is. It's a really really dire situation. The book isn't all doom and gloom, however, and when you talk about wilderness, we're not just talking about parks now. We're talking about what Dave Foreman calls rewilding and trying to create nature corridors, particularly through the Rockies and the West from Canada to Mexico. And it's an idea that really excites me because it allows for movement and migration of animals. You know, if you put animals in a contained park, you're putting them in something where change can occur, and evolution can occur, and migration can occur. And at least if we give them room to move, we give them room to adapt to what's coming. One of the things that I need when I deal with environmental issues is to not curl up into a little ball mm-hmm. out of just being overwhelmed and panicked. And somehow the idea of large corridors of wilderness is something that still gets my kind of blood flowing in a positive way so that I don't curl up in that ball. And so I think we're thinking beyond parks. We're thinking of connecting parks and connective tissue and ways that animals can adapt. Of course, there's also scientists who are literally moving animals to different places because of climate change. But I think, and I'm not being critical of that, but I just love the aspect of some wildness still left in the equation.
And your book is All the Wild That Remains, Edward Abbey, Wallace Stegner, and the American West. It's really a wonderful melding of literary history, and environmental hope for the future. Thanks so much, David Gessner, for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Gessner is the author of numerous books, including Return of the Osprey and Soaring with Fidel. He teaches writing at the University of North Carolina and founded the award-winning literary journal Ecotone. You can hear an audiobook clip from All the Wild That Remains and read an article by him adapted from the book at writersvoice.net. Next up, we air an excerpt from our 2012 interview with Gessner about his book My Green Manifesto. Then, the true story of Thanksgiving. Stay tuned after the break.
Just 6x3.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. David Gessner writes wonderful books about nature, but when he took a canoe trip down the Charles River, he wasn't seeing pristine, unspoiled wilderness, but the wildness that still remains in and among our human-built environment. It got him thinking about a new approach to environmentalism, one that embraces the limited wild, as he calls it, to make us aware of what we still have and protect it. I spoke to Gessner in 2012 about his book, My Green Manifesto, Down the Charles River in Pursuit of a New Environmentalism. In this segment, he talks about his companion and guide on the trip down the Charles, environmental planner Dan Driscoll, the man who greened the Charles River.
And it's kind of about the evolution of my environmental thought from Sick of Nature, which I wrote a few years back, to the present. And that evolution was really about me getting less pure environmentally and embracing a wilder and funnier and kind of more hypocritical environmentalism. And coincidentally, as my thinking was growing this way, I went down the Charles River with Dan Driscoll, who's an eco-planner for the state of Massachusetts, and he kind of embodied that same sort of spirit, like not a nature shaman whispering in hushed whispers, but a kind of funny salt-of-the-earth guy. And so I thought, this is a good match. We've got Dan, we've got this funny trip where we've got a case of beer in the canoe, and I've got these evolving ideas about how environmentalism, or at least my environmentalism, has changed.
And it's a wonderful discourse and a kind of conversation that you have the reader have with the book because of this. But, you know, I bet some of our listeners are saying to themselves, what does he mean, hypocritical environmentalism?
Right. Well, this is what I mean by it. And I'll let Dan, you know, speak for both of us. We were paddling on the second day of our trip, heading toward Boston, and Dan said, you know, we're all hypocrites. We all drive cars. We take plane rides. I mean, people like Al Gore or Bill McKibben have to fly to give their lecture about using less fuel. But we're hypocrites, and then we kind of say that lets us off the hook. We say, well, I use a car. I use a plane, so I can't really be an environmentalist. And he says, screw that. We need more environmentalists who fight. We need to say, okay, I'm a hypocrite. I'm part of these times. I can't avoid the car world, but I'm going to fight for some causes. And so I loved when he said that, and I thought, this is a limited environmentalism, not a either-or purist environmentalism. And it really matched what we were seeing on the way into the city, where we were seeing kind of all these moments of wildness and seeing birds. But we were going into, you know, a large metropolitan area. So I liked that, too. It was a limited wild, and it was a limited environmentalism, too.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Dan. Actually, tell us about his relationship with the Charles River. What has he done?
Yeah, well, at first, I only knew Dan because I played on an Ultimate Frisbee team with him, and we called him Danimal because he threw his body around and dove after Frisbees and had all this energy. And then one day after playing, I started a conversation and asked him what he did. And the conversation really turned into the book, because what he did 20 years ago was take a position as an eco-planner on the DCR, Department of Conservation and Recreation in Boston. And he was the young guy, so they gave him some maps and said, why don't you work on the Charles? And this was a thankless task because there was no way you could do much with the Charles. It's so famously polluted. It was the Scandell song, Dirty Water. But Dan started to dig in and look, and he saw that century before, Charles Eliot had purchased all this land along the river that had since been encroached on by businesses and people and residential homes. And he started to envision creating green paths, like bike paths, along the Charles and native plantings so he would re-green the banks. And the amazing thing, as I say at the beginning of the book, is he did it. This is not a depressing environmental story. This is an exciting one. He actually, through energy, charisma, and sheer oomph, managed to get this land back, have people agree to putting the pass through and the native plantings, and things that were like the parking lot of a super Stop and Shop suddenly were a green and marshy forest. So he spent 20 years doing that and did it in his own unique style, and I really admired it.
And what was it about his style that makes him the kind of environmentalist that you think we need more of?
Well, he's kind of a, you know, towny guy from Newton and outside of Boston. He says early on, I don't know how much swearing I'm allowed to do on the writer's voice, but he says early on that he, as a kid, had his ass dragged out to Lincoln to learn about nature. And what he wants to show is that nature can be closer to home. And he says, I think in the second page of the book, he says, maybe if people in Boston, kids in Boston, get out to the water, they can be inspired and they can be the next John Muir. And then he kind of corrects himself and says, or at least maybe they can be less of a dick.
Yeah.
So he's kind of saying that, you know, that contact with the natural world is something essential. And the thing I like about it is at this time I was writing the book, everything was green this, green that, green underarm deodorant, you know, green toothpaste. But everybody talked about that stuff. But they didn't seem to talk about where it starts, which is getting out in the world and going for walks and being in the world. And at the end of the book, I do bullet points. And the first two are fall in love with the place and start a fight about that place. And to me, that's the piece that's missing when everybody gets green. They forget about the actual green.
I take your point.
I didn't mean to make it so adamantly.
No, and I think it's an important one. I do take it. But I have to say, you know, I probably am in that camp that you criticize so roundly in the book, you know, the people who are in the equivalent of a panic attack, because we probably have run out of time. So have you been able to kind of integrate these two things?
Yeah, yeah. Up to this point, I've given you the standard Green Manifesto spiel. But this is really good. I mean, this is exactly, to me, this is one of the central parts of the book. I do criticize roundly, you know, quite a few people, but I don't think I criticize the doom and gloom thing because I believe it. I'm with you. And when I really think about it a lot, and I know species are dying every day and population booming, I, like you, have that equivalent of a intellectual kind of panic attack about it. And I don't think that's wrong. I think that's a legitimate response to very dark times environmentally. And I'm not criticizing that response. I'm saying, okay, there's that response. And then just like in our lives when we have panic attacks, how do we get out of them? And my experience has been, we usually get out of them through small actions and momentum and movement. Just like with writing, if you're overwhelmed by the book, the big book idea, well, you start and work on a chapter and you get momentum building. So all I'm saying is, even if doom is a fact of the future, we still have to wake up the next day. We still have our coffee. We still go to work. So I take Dan as an example of somebody who's done small things that can actually lead to fairly large things. It's not like I'm being head in the sand hopeful and saying this is going to save the world, but it's got to start with something, you know. And so to me, as the book started to evolve, at one point I got where I said, this is a young adult book in a lot of ways. I'm writing this for my 16-year-old self because I didn't know what to do. And one of the things to do is, just as a writer follows, you know, wants to do what they love, so people fighting for the green world do. And so the end of that chapter, the last phrase is, go get them. You know, it's kind of, it doesn't solve that problem. I'm totally with you on the big problem, but I still come around to the practical element of what is to be done, you know, what is to be done today.
That was David Gessner speaking on Writer's Voice in 2012 about his book, My Green Manifesto. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview.
Ya-nigga-wiz,
Well, it's Thanksgiving time again, a time when Native American storyteller Marge Bruchak gets a lot of requests to talk about the first Thanksgiving, when the English settlers got together with the Wampanoag natives of Massachusetts for a feast. The year was 1621. Bruchak co-authored the book 1621, A New Look at Thanksgiving. We talked to her in 2005 and thought it was a good idea to bring it to you again today. I started out by asking Marge Bruchak what really happened way back then.
It was not a Thanksgiving. Thanksgivings to the Puritans were specific religious ceremonies. They often involved a day of prayer. They often involved a great deal of fasting. And feasts were an entirely different kind of activity. The feast was more like a harvest home feast, more sort of a carryover of old English harvest traditions. Thanksgivings for Native people were held on each of the 13 full moons of the year. So it just so happened that this coming together of Plymouth colonists and Wampanoag people happened near a full moon in the autumn and at a time of great hardship for the Plymouth colony. Because here's the thing. People often imagine that it was many, many Puritan pilgrims and a handful of Native people. But in fact, there were more than 90 Native people present. They were the vast majority. Of the colonists themselves, there were only 52 out of the original 103 English colonists still alive. Most of them had perished during the winter.
And how long had the colonists been here?
They had been there since the November of the previous winter. And so there were only 4 adult women. There were only 16 adult males. And in addition, there were 9 seamen and servants who worked on the ship but were not considered members of the colony per se. And there were 23 children. So sometimes you see these 19th century illustrations of the feast as though all of these English women are feeding these poor starving Indians, when in fact there are over 90 of Massasoit's people, and then their women and children.
Who was Massasoit?
Massasoit was one of the key sachems of the Wampanoag people. He was a leader commonly known as a chief. His name, in fact, means great chief. His given name was Osemequin. So Massasoit is a title more than anything. He was from the Poconoka people who are in present-day eastern Rhode Island. And his decision to form an alliance with the English was very strategic at that moment in time. At that moment, the Wampanoag were engaged in conflict with the Narragansett in present-day Rhode Island, and the Wampanoag thought it might behoove them to have good trading relations with a small English colony that they could carefully control. I think they had no idea that so many colonists would come. They understood that this small colony were religious separatists, they were iconoclasts. I think they thought this was a manageable group. And they also didn't understand the degree to which the colonists intended to take over Wampanoag territory. So, for instance, any so-called unimproved or wild or untilled land was considered the property of Christians, despite the fact that Native people had been living on it for millennia.
It considered by the pilgrims.
By the pilgrims.
Right.
I want to step forward into this timeline of how Thanksgiving morphs into an American holiday. Because one thing that few people understand is the fact that most of the colonial Thanksgiving days were actually celebrations for victories over the Indians. So the first regional Thanksgiving celebrated in New England was actually in 1637 after the Pequot War. There were small individual days of Thanksgiving within Massachusetts Bay Colony and Plymouth Colony, but the victory over the Pequots, literally the massacre at the Mashantucket Pequot Fort, was declared a region-wide Thanksgiving. Massachusetts Bay Colony set aside October 12th as a special day of Thanksgiving for subduing the Pequots, and there was a similar Thanksgiving day established after King Philip's War, when Metacom, Massasoit's son, was killed after that rebellion. His head was put on a pole, put in the middle of Plymouth Colony, and the day of his death was declared a day of Thanksgiving. So it makes me shudder sometimes to think that we rarely talk about that aspect of Thanksgiving. And even the way Thanksgiving became a national holiday owes much to the Civil War, when Abraham Lincoln declared that we should have a day for celebrating the blessings of field and the fruits of the field, and it should be a national holiday. And that ties in with a woman named Sarah Josepha Hale, who thought we needed a day to celebrate the founding fathers and celebrate families coming together to feast. So in a way, all of these American Thanksgivings over time have very little to do with celebrating Native presence on this landscape and have a great deal to do with claiming the landscape as English or as American territory devoid of Indians.
Well, that's a pretty tragic foundation to this holiday. And yet there was a kind of congress, I'd say, between the two peoples. When you're talking, I guess, before King Philip's War, before these massacres, there was a kind of connection. There was a feast at which the Indians and the pilgrims came together. What's this about?
As I say, it's very strategic. To kind of back up for a moment, Squanto is often held up as a hero. And there are many children's books, and there are moments in curricula across the country where people teach about Squanto helping the pilgrims. Squanto is seen to many Wampanoag people as a traitor. He was also seen in his own time as a direct traitor to Massasoit. Massasoit's strategy was to negotiate a very careful peace with this one colony in order to facilitate trade and in order to have allies in any potential conflict with other groups. Squanto tried to manipulate that for his own ends. A man named Hobomok, who lived very close to the Plymouth colony, was actually sent there to keep an eye on them, to watch over them. So the thing that's important to remember is that it was a strategic peace, it was a delicate peace, and it was never as stable as it should have been or could have been, in part because there wasn't balance on both sides. I'll give you a great example. There's a moment in the Plymouth colony records when Massasoit has gathered together a number of sachems to confirm this peace, and the terms of the agreement are reiterated over 20 times. Each sachem has to speak for his community and recaps the entire summary of what's just been said. And in the Plymouth colony records, the pilgrims are saying, what is it with these people? Is it not good enough to say it once? But what you're seeing is a model of Native consensus. You're seeing the fact that every one of those Wampanoag communities has to assent that no one community can take another's fate into its hands. And even Massasoit, as a central chief, is responsible to all of those people. Whereas the English style of government is so dramatically different. What we call representative democracy means that one person is chosen to speak for everyone else. And they can often go off on their own and make decisions that might harm the entire community. So when you look at the leaders of the Plymouth colony, and when you look at the leaders of the Wampanoag communities, they're negotiating in dramatically different ways. And the Plymouth colonists are after one thing more than anything else, and that's land. They intend to expand. They intend to stay. They do not intend to allow Wampanoag people to hold on to their sovereignty.
Right. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're speaking with Marge Bruschak, author of 1621, A New Look at Thanksgiving.
The entire myth of this event as the so-called First Thanksgiving, as this foundational moment in American history, is based on Edward Winslow's account of a 1621 autumn harvest feast, when he writes, "We set the last spring some 20 acres of Indian corn, and sowed some 6 acres of barley and peas, and according to the manner of the Indians, we manured our ground with herrings, or rather shads, which we have in great abundance, and take with great ease at our doors. Our corn did prove well, and God be praised, we had a good increase of Indian corn, and our barley indifferent good, but our peas not worth the gathering." And he goes on to note that that was the first successful harvest they had had, and being that it was a good harvest, it was time to gather together and celebrate the harvest.
So why did they choose to invite the Indians, or did they choose
to
invite
the Indians? Well, they didn't. That's the important. That's a very important detail people often miss. They did not say, let's have a harvest and invite the Indians. What they did is they started gathering all of this food, and then they decided to have some military maneuvers. And so what brought Massasoit is the fact that the Plymouth colonists, who remember had signed a peace treaty with Massasoit, were walking around firing off their guns, wearing their armor, and suddenly doing military maneuvers. So when Massasoit showed up with 90 men to investigate what's going on, you can tell from the records that he was suspicious. It's only after he arrives and realizes that it's a feast they're preparing for that he sends his men out and they hunt four deer and bring them back. And so the largest quantity of food is not even this harvest that the colonists have brought in using native technology, using native styles of fertilizing and everything else to prepare the food.
You mean with the fish?
Right. Mm-hmm. That's not the bulk of the food. The bulk of the food is the deer and the corn and the native food that Massasoit and his people bring.
Now, I have a question.
Yeah.
You've shown us how the myth differs from the reality. Well, you've shown us how the reality differs from the myth. And yet that myth is there. It's a very powerful one. What do you think that's about? Have you done any thinking about why was this myth necessary? Why was it necessary for white Americans to create a myth of friendship with the peoples that they had conquered?
The important point to make is not there was friendship. There was a negotiated friendship. The myth implies that Native people had already vanished by that moment in time, and that the few Indians who were left were invited to a feast that the English hosted. So I think the nature of the myth gives the English a sense of dominance over the landscape and over the history at a moment in time when they were, in fact, struggling and starving and about to disappear themselves.
There's something about that one big happy family.
Right, that's the mythical part, that one big happy multicultural family. That forgets the fact that this is native landscape. It forgets the fact that the Plymouth colony is very, very small. And the entire continent of North America, the entire continent of South America, is all Indian country. Even though there have been plagues, even though there has been contact, it's all Indian country. And so what often happens is that tiny little Plymouth colony hanging on for dear life on the coast is made to look much larger than it is in fact and is given so much more power than it has at that moment in time. And that power just extends across the continent with manifest destiny. And I think that's the danger of the myth. If it were a truer rendition of the story, you would start from the Wampanoag perspective of a long inhabited landscape, more than 12,000 years, and considering how you deal with this small band of strangers who enter into your landscape. And you would learn from the Wampanoag point of view that negotiation, reaching out, helping strangers is part of their way. And even little details like the first person to encounter the colonists is not Massasoit, it's Samoset, who is an Abenaki sachem. He's from north in what's now Maine. And he's traveled down to this territory, and he sees these people, and he knows who these people are. They've been taking captives from the coast for several decades now. There are more than 80 Native people stolen from Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Wampanoag territory, all up and down the coast have already been taken back to England as captives. None of these Native people are in awe at the arrival of the pilgrims, but they make a decision, and the decision they make on the spot is a negotiated peace. And I think that's what's lost in that myth of the happy family.
One of the reasons the English colonists survived is that the Wampanoag showed them how to grow corn. Marge Bruchak is a member of the Abenaki tribe. She told us her people's story of how they were given corn.
The story that we have in Abenaki territory talks about corn as a young woman who comes in the middle of winter during a starving time. And when she comes to the people, she's very tall and very lean. She has a long green dress that rustles when she walks. And she asks for a place to stay through the winter. And the people take her in, and they give her room in a lodge, and she sleeps with four grandmothers. And she spends the whole winter with the people. And through that winter, she can't speak their language, but she learns a few words. She listens to the story. She watches how the old care for the young and how the young care for the old. And when spring comes, she gathers those people together, and she says to them that she is grateful for the way they have cared for her, even though she is a stranger. She's grateful for the way they have treated her like a sister, and she has a gift to give to them. And she tells them to give them this gift, she will have to die. And the people say, "Oh no, sister, you don't have to die. We have good medicine people. We can cure you." And she says, "No, no. When I die, You will take my body, and you will lay it in your fields. You will pile the earth over it, and you will watch that place, and my gift will come to you. And so with heavy hearts, the people do as they have been asked to do, and they take that woman's body and they lay it in the fields, and they pile the earth over it, and they watch, and they wait. And when spring comes on, a small green plant grows out of that place, and it is just the color of that woman's green dress. And it keeps growing. And as that plant gets a little taller, it has leaves that come out and they rustle the way that woman's dress used to rustle when she walked. And the plant keeps growing. And when it gets to be as tall as that woman was tall, it grows seed pods on the side. And from each of those seed pods is hanging long strands of sandy brown hair, like that woman's hair. And when they peel open the seed pods, there's the gift. And this is the food she gives to them. And so the people right away, they give thanks, Bemkikta, Kikta, Olioni, to the earth and sky for helping that plant to grow. They give thanks to that woman for coming to them. They give thanks to all of the grandmothers for looking after that woman like she was their own kin. And there's a song that goes along with that. It's called the Green Corn Song. And it's usually sung in four parts, thanking the four grandmothers that looked after that woman. And it kind of goes like this. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Olalikikwehawanneo, 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 Olalikikwehawanneo.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.